the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network presents Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis. Each week, Joan brings you news from inside the Vatican and the Church around the world, as well as interviews and answers to your questions. Now, here's the host of Vatican Insider, Joan Lewis.
Welcome to a new edition of Vatican Insider. This weekend, I bring you a special I prepared in light of Pope Francis' scheduled trip to Iraq from March 5th to the 8th. This special is all about the behind the scenes, the myriad preparations, the making of a papal trip. EWTN, of course, will be covering this historic trip, the first ever visit of a pope to this part of the Middle East. I know it will be a trip watched by media around the world. Say a prayer for the good health and safety of all involved in this apostolic voyage. Now the news highlights of the week. Sunday, February 21st, speaking to pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square for the Angelus, Pope Francis explained how the Word of God shows us the path to live fruitfully the 40 days of Lent we have just begun. It is with faith, prayer, and penance that we can overcome evil. After reciting the Marian prayer with the faithful, the Holy Father greeted Polish pilgrims in St. Peter's Square and recalled the Shrine of Divine Mercy in Plock, Poland. He said it was here 90 years ago that the Lord appeared to Sister Faustina Kowalska and entrusted her with a special message of divine mercy that St. John Paul II helped bring to the world's knowledge and appreciation. Francis encouraged the faithful to open their hearts with faith and to put trust in Jesus. The Pope also greeted pilgrims from the Talitha Cum group of the San Giovanni dei Fiorentini parish in Rome, encouraging them to continue their charitable work with joy. Traditionally, the evening of the Sunday following Ash Wednesday, the Pope and ranking members of the Roman Curia depart the Vatican to go to a retreat center outside of Rome to start 6 days of spiritual exercises. However, given the COVID pandemic and the need to be cautious about gathering in groups, Pope Francis decided it would be necessary for him and members of the Roman Curia to do individual retreats this year. Curial retreats in the past began late Sunday afternoon and ended Friday or Saturday morning. All papal appointments, including the weekly general audience, are suspended at this time. In his Lenten message for 2021, Pope Francis wrote, "Lent is a time for believing, for welcoming God into our lives and allowing Him to make His dwelling among us. In our Lenten journey towards Easter, let us remember the one who humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even death on a cross." And again, in his homily during the Ash Wednesday Mass, celebrated in St. Peter's Basilica on February 17th, the Pope explained that Lent is a journey that involves our whole life, our entire being. It's time to reconsider the path we are taking, to find the route that leads us home, and to rediscover our profound friendship with God, on whom everything depends. Lent is not just about the little sacrifices we make, but about discerning where our hearts are directed. This is the core of Lent. On Monday, February 22nd, the Vatican released Pope Francis's letter to the Bishop and the Church of Plock, Poland, on the occasion of the 90th anniversary of the first apparition of the Merciful Jesus to St. Maria Faustina Kowalska, a Polish nun. The apparitions to St. Faustina formed the basis of the Divine Mercy devotion. Francis recalled the words heard by St. Faustina on February 22nd, 1931. "Paint a picture, according to the design you see, with the caption, 'Jesus, I trust in you.' I desire that this image be venerated first in your chapel and then throughout the world." Also on Monday, February 22nd, the Universal Church, and St. Peter's Basilica in particular, celebrated the solemnity of the Cathedra, or the Chair of Peter, a recurrence dating back to the 4th century that honors and celebrates the primacy and authority of St. Peter. All morning masses were celebrated at the splendid altar of the chair, aglow throughout the day with over 100 candles. In fact, this is one of 2 days every year when the candles are lit, and the statue of a seated St. Peter, on the right side of the main aisle as you walk towards the papal altar, is robed in ecclesiastical finery, including papal vestments, the triple tiara, and a papal ring. The other day this is done is June 29th, the Feast of Saints Peter and Paul, Apostles, patrons of Rome. The word cathedra means seat or throne, and it's the root of the word cathedral, the church where a bishop has his throne and from whence he preaches. Another word for cathedra is sede, seat or see, S-E-E. The see is the place from which a bishop governs his diocese. Thus, for example, the Holy See, also called the See of Peter, is the see of the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. The chair of Peter is actually a throne that Charles the Bald, the grandson of the Emperor Charlemagne, gave to Pope John VIII at the former's coronation as emperor on Christmas Day 875. For many years, the chair was used at liturgical events by Pope John and his successors. It was ensconced in Bernini's altar of the chair in 1666. On Tuesday, February 23rd, the Pope sent a telegram to Italian President Sergio Mattarella on the death of Italian Ambassador Luca Attanasio to the Democratic Republic of the Congo. He noted the exemplary witness of the ambassador and the expert and generous service of the police officer accompanying him and their Congolese driver all died in the attack Monday on their United Nations convoy. Pope Francis said he was saddened when he heard the news, expressed heartfelt condolences to their families, the diplomatic service, and the Carabinieri on the death of these servants of peace. He noted the ambassador's dedication to, quote, establishing fraternal and cordial relationships and to reestablishing serene and harmonious relationships in the heart of this African country. He mentioned Vittorio Iacovacci, a member of the Italian Carabinieri, also killed in the attack, describing him as expert and generous in his service, and he was about to form a new family. Wednesday, February 24th. There was no audience on Wednesday because the Holy Father was on retreat. Thursday, February 25th was also a quiet day for Pope Francis, who was still on that personal retreat. Friday, February 26th, Cardinal Raniero Cantalamessa, preacher of the papal household, gave the first Lenten sermon on the theme, Who Do You Say I Am? He preached to members of the Roman Curia in the Paul VI Hall. Pope Francis was not in attendance. Welcome to the Q&A. Again this week, I answer a question about sacred vessels, the proper materials for them and use of them. This comes from a book, Liturgical Question Box, written by a good friend, now retired, Auxiliary Bishop Peter Elliott of Melbourne, Australia. A person wrote in to ask, In one parish I know the people drink the precious blood from wine glasses. Surely this is not allowed. Bishop Elliott replied, In parishes where the people drink from the chalice, an appropriate set of smaller metal chalices may well be used, but never wine glasses. As already noted, not only are such vessels excluded by the principles of durability, but there is a clear rule that secular vessels are not to be used at Mass. The instruction from the Congregation for Divine Worship, Inestimabile Donum, number 16, rules out, quote, simple baskets and other vessels for ordinary use outside the sacred celebration. Because an ecclesiastical shop sells a wine glass or glass goblet, does not magically turn it into a chalice. Moreover, as anyone who washes dishes knows, it's also more difficult to clean drinking vessels made of glass or ceramic, as that adds a further complication to the purifications.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
Called you guys a couple of years ago telling you that I had an answer for your question. There's nothing going to stop me from becoming a Catholic. I'm about to start my third year. It's been a beautiful journey. And some advice for people who are thinking about becoming Catholic. Oh my goodness, listen to EWTN day and night. It's just beautiful. Forget the mainstream media. Just stick to EWTN. You'll learn so much and you'll want to become a Catholic like now.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Unplanned, the true story of Abby Johnson.
I would be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
She believed in a woman's right to choose.
I've had an abortion myself, so I don't have any problem with another woman making the same decision.
Until the day she saw something that changed everything.
Tiny, perfect little baby. And then it was just gone.
Now she's pulling back the curtain on the abortion industry. Unplanned.
Available at EWTNRC.com and the EWTN app.
Hi, this is Trent Horn from Catholic Answers, and a lot of people ask me, how do you pray? I like the ACTS formula, A-C-T-S. First, we adore God, realize He's God, we are not. We're contrite, we ask Him to forgive us of our sins. We're thankful, we thank Him for the blessings and trials He's given us. And then we make supplications and ask Him for help in our own lives, doing all of this so we can grow closer to Him and spend eternity with Him.
Welcome back to Vatican Insider. Here's Joan Lewis.
Welcome to what is normally the interview segment of Vatican Insider. However, this weekend I bring you a special I've prepared in light of Pope Francis' scheduled trip to Iraq from March 5th to the 8th. This special is all about the behind the scenes, the myriad preparations, the making of a papal trip. EWTN, of course, will be covering this historic trip, the first ever visit of a pope to this part of the Middle East. I know it will be a trip watched by media around the world. Say a prayer for the good health and safety of all involved in this apostolic voyage. Now, some statistics about papal trips. During his almost 27-year reign, Pope John Paul II, the Pilgrim Pope, made 104 foreign trips, more than all previous popes combined. In total, he logged more than 1.1 million kilometers, or 725,000 miles. Pope Benedict XVI made 25 foreign trips. The last one before his February 2013 resignation was to Lebanon in September 2012. Exactly how are papal trips planned? I've often been asked about the behind-the-scenes work in the making of a papal trip and thought I'd tell you about that today. Everything looks so easy when you see an event unfold before your eyes on television. But untold numbers of people are involved in massive undertakings such as papal trips, and they are, almost always, the unsung heroes of the front-page news stories. There are also, I might add, very interesting behind-the-scene activities that take place in the lives of the journalists who cover these events. While working at the Vatican, I did research for a story on the behind-the-scenes preparation for a papal trip, including a general overview of plans and a specific look at how the liturgical side of an apostolic trip is readied by the Master of Liturgical Ceremonies of the Supreme Pontiff. I thought you might be interested in how such a trip unfolds. Now, months of preparation by dozens of people, especially the so-called papal advance man, go into the planning and execution of a trip abroad, so that all events, from the landing of the Pope's plane to the arrival of luggage, to ground transportation, security, meals, meetings, and liturgical celebrations, run smoothly. And while they're important for the successful undertaking of a papal trip, such preparations are secondary to the primary pastoral nature of these apostolic visits. In the weeks and months that precede a trip, Vatican and local ecclesial officials meet both in the Vatican and on the site of the planned visit to determine physical locales and timetables for the encounters and liturgical functions. In a so-called dress rehearsal of the Pope's trip, they actually visit each spot the Pope will visit in order to judge the distance to be traveled between two points, the time needed to cover it, and the length of the ceremony involved. Often, for example, the advance team will walk the distance between a car, the papal vehicle, and the entrance to a church or other building to see how long that takes. Of course, any impromptu handshaking by the Pope can ruin a well-timed schedule, and we've seen that often with Pope Francis. In the early stages of planning a papal trip, relatively few people are involved. Key officials from the Vatican include the advance man and the Master of Liturgical Ceremonies of the Supreme Pontiff. The current MC is Monsignor Guido Marini, the same last name as the MC who served to Pope John Paul for two decades. They work closely with the Ecclesial Organizing Committee of the host country, as well as with civilian authorities, such as those in charge of security, protocol, transportation, communications, and medical assistance. Authorities in the host country are principally responsible for security measures, but they work hand in glove with Vatican security. In 2008, for the trip to the United States, the Secret Service was involved every moment of every day at every possible level, and that was true for Pope Francis's September 2015 trip to the U.S., also for a world meeting of families. The service knew the name, age, address, and phone number, and perhaps even more, of every single person who attended a papal event. I was told they knew the occupant, for example, of every single seat in both National Stadium in Washington and Yankee Stadium in New York. even though the faithful had been previously chosen by a lottery procedure in the various parishes of the dioceses that distributed tickets. Secret Service agents were everywhere at the time and could be spotted by their gold lapel pins with a star in the center and, of course, the ever-present sunglasses when outside. To digress for a moment, I have to give the Secret Service credit during the U.S. trip, for they were really spread thin. They always covered the president, of course, but in Washington they had to add the Pope to the mix, and my understanding was that the papal visit is the second highest security level for the service, following the top security level of a presidential inauguration. Britain's Prime Minister Gordon Brown came to town at the same time as the Pope, and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice had gone on a trip to the Middle East. The Secret Service played a huge role in the day-to-day work of the media in the U.S. I had been through security before, both here in the Vatican and on other papal trips, but absolutely nothing compared to our 6 days in the States. Many hours before attending a papal event, journalists going to the event had to be swept by the service. When the Secret Service announces start of sweep, all properly tagged journalists line up exactly where and how the agents tell you. You are wearing your double photo media ID credential, the large one from the Catholic Bishops' Conference and the smaller one from the Secret Service, to which is added a plastic color and word-coded, what's called a hang tag, for the specific event you will attend. For example, our hang tag for Dunwoody Youth Rally was yellow with RLY9 written on it, Rally 9. All cameras and camera equipment, tripods, lights, cables, etc., and computers are put on the floor against one wall of a corridor, and the owners of those items line up on the opposite wall. Computers and cameras must be open and working. Journalists then proceed to a separate room where there's an airport-style security, pockets emptied of keys, coins, etc. We wait in a holding room until our group is finished, after which we reclaim our belongings that were checked out or swept by a canine and other electronic equipment. This was done between 5 and 6 hours before the start of an event. Relatively similar precautions take place in other countries, but not at this level, I've been told. That's been my experience, at least. Now, back to preparations for a papal trip. As these preparations progress, more people become involved, especially in the host country. Altars must be built for outdoor sites. Tickets and programs for papal functions must be printed and distributed. Vestments, chalices, patens, etc. must be procured in greater than usual quantities for masses, and security must be arranged. By the way, I cannot stress enough that all papal events are always free. Why do popes make such trips that are often lengthy and physically demanding? Pope John Paul, on the vigil of his 1980 visit to Brazil, one of those 104 foreign apostolic trips he took as pope, said, quote, "The pope travels, supported as was Peter, by the prayer of the entire church, to announce the gospel, to confirm brothers and sisters in the faith, to console the church, to meet man. These are trips of faith," said the pope, "of prayer, which always have at their center the meditation on and proclamation of the word of God, the Eucharistic celebration, the invocation of Mary. These trips are also occasions," said St. John Paul, "for an itinerant catechesis, for an extended announcing of the gospel and the apostolic magisterium to all corners of the earth. They are trips of love, of peace, of universal fraternity. In these meetings of souls, even in the immense crowds, one sees that charism of today's Petrine ministry on the paths of the world. This, and only this, is the scope of the Pilgrim Pope, even if some would like to attribute other motives. This is the apostolic way, Peter's way, Paul's way. The technical means at our disposition today facilitate this method." Pope John Paul at that time also underlined that his pilgrimages to the local churches served to demonstrate the place they occupy in the universal mission of the church, and to underline the particular nature they have in building the universality of the church. So, how does a pontiff decide when and where he will travel? All invitations that come to the Vatican from local churches are studied and evaluated. Many factors are contemplated before a decision is made, although two can influence a choice: geography and special events. The Pope and his aides usually seek areas to which he has not previously traveled, and they try to alternate geographic regions. They look at the climate of a potential destination and whether a country will be host to an international event such as a Eucharistic Congress or World Youth Day, or as we're seeing now, a World Meeting of Families. Benedict XVI came to the U.S. in response to an invitation to address the United Nations, and also at a time when four American archdioceses were celebrating their bicentenary. In addition to the invitation of a local church, there must also be an invitation, or at least the consent, of the host country's government. Papal trips are always pastoral, never political. The Pope resides only in ecclesial buildings, the nunciatur, or apostolic delegation, a bishop's residence, rectories, seminaries, or religious houses. He never stays in a government building or guest house, nor does he travel with government leaders or take part in official government banquets. I found it strange once when some of the media announced that Pope Benedict skipped a dinner at the White House in his honor. He did not skip the dinner. It was in his honor, but he had not been scheduled to attend. Once it's been decided where the Pope will travel, it is then determined how long he wants to be in a country and at what time of the year he will visit. A primary consideration in planning trips are previously scheduled appointments in the Vatican or annual celebrations, such as Christmas and Easter. The peripatetic Pope John Paul's personal wish was never to be away from Rome for long periods, the maximum being 12 or 13 days. When the final papal approval is given, other Vatican offices move into high gear, including that for liturgical celebrations and the Holy See Press Office. The Pope now starts to work on the speeches, greetings, and homilies he will give in the course of a trip. Often he personally writes or dictates the guidelines and outlines of every discourse, although some speeches he may write in their entirety. And, as we have seen, Pope Francis has been known to put the written speech aside and speak off the cuff for short or even long periods. Aides, assisted by background material from the Secretariat of State on the country's social and religious situation, then write the speech in the language in which it will be pronounced. The pontiff then corrects and or adds to these drafts, and speeches are translated into numerous languages. After a site has been chosen, the papal advance man and a small group of assistants travel to the host country or countries. Normally, only a few visits are required, as local prelates also come to Rome. Telephone calls, faxes, and emails do the rest. When I spoke years ago to Father Roberto Tucci, later Cardinal Tucci, at Vatican Radio, he had been the Pope's advance man for years. He told me he had traveled so often to so many places for papal trips that when people saw him, even when he was in a place on vacation, they automatically assumed the Pope was coming. At the end of our talk about St. John Paul's trips, I asked Father Tucci if the Holy Father had any special dietary needs or requests. He said no ice, no spice, no cold beverages, and if they were cold, John Paul put his hands around the glass to warm it up, and no spicy food. Tasty, yes. Hot and spicy, no. Obviously, any special dietary preferences or allergies are always reported to those in charge of meals where the Pope will be staying. Immediate preparations for a papal trip also include meetings with the commercial airlines that transport the Pope and his entourage. The Italian airline Alitalia accompanies the Holy Father on the first leg of his destination, whereas the carrier of the host nation often accompanies him to his next destination or back to Rome. One section of the plane is always for the Pope and his entourage, and the economy section is for journalists. The papal entourage normally numbers about 30 people, including the Cardinal Secretary of State and several other officials from the Secretariat of State who speak the language or languages of the country or countries to be visited. There's also the prefect of the papal household, the Pope's private secretary, his physician, the director of the Holy See Press Office and his assistant, several members of the Swiss Guards, members of the Pontifical Gendarmerie, and the papal advance man and several others from Vatican Radio. Often, curial cardinals who are from the host nation and other cardinals who've had ties to that nation are included. Journalists from print and electronic media number around 70 may pay an airfare equivalent to business or first class. Next on the agenda of the papal advance man is the selection of locations for papal meetings, masses, and other celebrations. Such choices are made based on a variety of factors, often including the percentage and number of Catholics in a country. Where there are few Catholics, a cathedral might be sufficient for mass. where there are many, an open place, such as a stadium, racetrack, or park, must be sought out. These sites are important because liturgical celebrations are the heart of all papal trips. On the liturgical side, things are just as meticulous. Separate papal ceremonies require separate papal vestments. These are carefully chosen, usually handcrafted, then laid out and packed. Each container of vestments is earmarked for a specific liturgy and bears a number and the name and location of the liturgy. There is a written list of all containers. That list is checked by the official who accompanies the containers to the airport, checking and double-checking as they are loaded onto the plane. Another official is at the arrival airport and may, too, check and double-check all vestment containers as they're taken off the plane. In setting up daily schedules for the pontiff, there's usually a threefold objective: not to arrange events before 8 a.m., to set aside some time after lunch so the Pope and his entourage can rest, and to conclude the day's public events by 9 p.m. when possible. A Pope's spontaneous forays into crowds can often force modifications in well-planned schedules. One very visible part of the Holy Father's land travels is the large white vehicle that has come to be known as the Popemobile. Now, this is not a Vatican invention. The Popemobile appeared during John Paul's first trip to Mexico in 1979. Other countries adopted the idea and over time made changes and improvements. Some of these Popemobiles have been sent as gifts to the Vatican, two from Spain, for example, and these in turn are now sent to countries in advance of a visit in order to avoid an unnecessary expense. As we have seen, Pope Francis often employs a more simple vehicle, sometimes just an almost anonymous sedan. If a papal trip seems smooth, it's because it was well planned and beautifully executed, like a well-choreographed ballet. By the way, the Holy Father's passport has a white leather cover and bears the number 1. But usually his face is enough ID.
For more information on these stories, or to check out Joan's blog and to ask her a question, go to EWTN.com. That's EWTN.com. Thanks for listening to Vatican Insider on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.